Hi, this is James Patrick Kelly, 9-time loser of the Nebula Award, 1-time winner, and I get my opinions from Upon Further Review.
Upon Further Review, I'm Greg.
I'm Claire.
And we want to welcome everyone to the show. As always, thank you for tuning in. We want to thank everyone for leaving comments and so forth over the last couple of weeks while we have been absent, because we've been setting up this show, which is going to be a little bit different than our normal show. A couple of weeks ago, I was at a conference called ReaderCon, which is a major science fiction and fantasy convention in the Boston area. But the difference between this and other science fiction and fantasy conventions where, you know, you're sort of elbowing Klingons away from the buffet table is that in this particular case, it's focused on literature specifically. And so everything is focused on the books, the authors who write them, the readers who read them. And that makes for a very different feel. I was there to read a portion of my second as yet unpublished novel. And the two guests of honor at this convention were Jonathan Lethem and James Patrick Kelly. Now, James Patrick Kelly is a science fiction author of considerable note. He's particularly focused on, in his career, on the short story, but he's also written novels and essays and reviews. He writes a regular column for the Asimov website. He has written plays. In fact, there were two one-act plays, I believe, that were performed at ReaderCon of his work. He even does a planetarium show, which I'll be interested to get more information about as far as that's concerned. And he is a both Hugo and Nebula Award-winning author. For those of you who don't know, those are the two major science fiction and fantasy writer awards that are given each year. He's won the Hugo twice for his novelette Think Like a Dinosaur, which was also adapted, Clea, into an Outer Limits episode, which I thought was pretty neat. I did not know that. And then in 2000 for his novelette 10 to the 16th to 1. And he won the Nebula Award for his novelette Burn in 2006, which has been anthologized numerous times as well. He has also co-edited anthologies. He is on the faculty of the MFA program at the University of Southern Maine, and also posts two weekly podcasts, Free Reads, and then his paid story pod via Audible, which is actually a paid gig, which I found out about at ReaderCon. He's the vice chair of the Clarion Foundation, and so he has taught many people at the Clarion Workshop, including Cory Doctorow and a number of others. And he was also the chair of the New Hampshire State Council on the Arts. So Mr. Kelly has been busy, and obviously. And at ReaderCon, I went to a panel on podcasting where he happened to be speaking along with about eight other panels that weekend, the poor guy. And he, you know, was talking about podcasting and its various uses in science fiction and fantasy. So I went up to him afterwards and said, you know, Mr. Kelly, and this, we run this show, and I'd be interested to have you on it. And I fully expecting him to tell me to, you know, go walk out the door.
Little peon, get away from me.
Right. And instead what he did was he said, I'd love to be on the show, and that's wonderful. And so we are extremely pleased and honored to welcome James Patrick Kelly to the show today. Jim, welcome.
Thank you very much. Gosh, what a great introduction. Is that all I've done so far?
I know. What's your second act, pray tell? And I guess I want to lead off by asking about the podcasting thing, because obviously that's a connection that our listeners will have here too. You were one of the early adopters of podcasting, especially for your own work. Have you done all of your work through podcasts, or just a significant portion of it?
A significant portion of it, I have, through the StoryPod podcast, which is the paid one, I've done 52 of my 80-some stories, which are mostly the good ones. I actually, when I started publishing, you know, I am not ashamed to say I served my apprenticeship in print. And so my first half dozen stories, let's say, are okay, but they're not prime Jim Kelly work, and I wouldn't necessarily recommend anyone start with them. The completists can go ahead and look them up if they care to. In terms of the novels, I have podcast two of my five novels and have plans to do some more, but podcasting a novel is a huge endeavor.
I'll bet.
It's almost as bad as writing one.
Yeah, right? I would bet, because I was going to ask about that. You know, since you were one of the early adopters of this, and I know you talked a little bit about this at ReaderCon, but do you think, I mean, obviously you think podcasting is a valuable thing, which is why you do it. And I guess the question would be a two-part question. One, why do you like it for your work? I mean, what is valuable about it in terms of getting your message out to your readers? And then secondly, why do you think more authors haven't embraced it in the same way? I mean, there are some that have, but I heard a lot of people at not just ReaderCon, but elsewhere who are a little bit, I don't know, uncertain about the technology or nervous about the intellectual property rights or something. So I wonder what you feel about podcasting generally and why you've found it valuable for your own stuff.
Well, let's start with the second part first. Yeah, I think that a lot of people are intimidated by the technology, and they're especially sort of caught in a 20th century mindset about what does copyright worth and how do I promote myself and should I not be sitting on all my stories waiting for Steven Spielberg or George Lucas to come and snatch them up and make me into a millionaire, which isn't actually going to happen. And so the internet in general, specifically, is a sharing the goodies, sharing what you do. So, you know, my thought on this is that I got paid for everything I podcast once, sometimes more than once. And so I have yet to find any editor who has said, oh, my gosh, you podcast that story now. I guess I just don't want to reprint it. Too bad, Jim.
You're sure that's not just because you deal with enlightened editors, though, Jim? That's the
Well, there's that. I mean, there's that. It's true, but it also is. I mean, I think that eventually, as podcasting comes closer to the center of online publishing, there may be more resistance, and people may say, well, this is used goods because it's been podcast. But right now, I don't think the print industry really has a clue about what's happening in podcasting. For myself, I used to listen to audiobooks on LPs. That's how long ago that was. Actually, wow. You can't actually get an audiobook on an LP, but I used to listen to writers reading on LPs, you know, 45 minutes on the side or 27 minutes on the side. And so it was kind of a thrill for me to take the means of production in my own hands and start doing audiobooks. I had been published, my stuff had been converted into audiobooks by, you know, some of the major publishers, Random House Audio, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And I only found intermittently did I like the performances. Some performances are better than I could ever do. Some performances were okay, and some performances, frankly, I just didn't like. And so not only could I sort of seize the means of production, but I could also direct myself and get at least a performance on recorded that I could be satisfied with.
It's interesting, even on a small scale, of thinking about how it is portrayed. I mean, we all think about a book being turned into a movie and you losing your rights and how it's done, but even on a small scale of an audio scale, you could see that you liked some, you didn't like others.
Oh, yeah. And I have to say that when I've been involved in a couple of digital initiatives, and all my agent especially has been very leery about some of my audio adventures. And so, and understandably, because this is new technology, and I'm sort of there in the second wave of people who are going out there and doing this. And so there's not a lot of case law, there's not a lot of business model behind what I'm doing. And so,
right.
You know, this is the case, though. So far, so good in terms of retaining rights and reselling rights of stuff that I've podcast.
I see.
So it's always painful to be the pioneer, I guess. Although in this case, not painful for you, because it really has given you benefit. I mean, you said, I believe, before that you would not have had the number of people, you know, I'd like to think, since you've been shortlisted and a finalist for the Hugo and Nebula many times, even when you didn't win. But I think you said before that you're not sure how far Byrne would have gone had it not gotten that initial exposure, right?
Absolutely. Well, you know, the story of Byrne is the story of a novella. It's actually a short novel, and a little publisher, small publisher, printed it, and it's not quite sold out, although it's done pretty well, but still. So let's just say, you know, 2,500 copies of that are out there in the world making their way. Some of them are in libraries. It got well-reviewed, obviously. But tens of thousands of people downloaded it as a podcast, and then when it got nominated for various awards, I talked my editor into allowing me to, you know, publish post a PDF of it. And so, like, you know, who knows? I've lost track, and there's really no way to know. Because it's a Creative Commons thing, which I'm a big supporter of, and one of the you know, things that happens when you post something in Creative Commons is you basically give people permission to post it wherever the hell they want, as long as they don't charge for it. And so I have no idea where else it's posted. I could do that search, but I've got better things to do, like writing.
Well, and you know, I was going to ask, you mentioned the small press thing as well. It seems to me that the direction of a lot of publishing and writing in the 21st century is going to be towards more direct contact between author and reader. I think that's part of the reason that you see the, you know, the surge in websites and comment forums and you know, making the author more available. And it seems to me that both in podcasting and also going the small press route, that there's a sense that you're more directly available. For example, you're willing to do an interview with our show, which if I went up to Neil Gaiman, I'd like to think that he would he's a nice guy and all, but you know, you get the impression that some of the old guard, maybe the Stephen King is a better example,
yeah, I think so,
might not be as willing to do that. And I wonder, you know, that suggests that maybe we're moving in a more direct connect sort of direction, I guess.
Well, this insight isn't new to me, and I can't attribute it to some smart person, but it's been pointed out that in the olden days, let's say in the 1800s, one of the ways that authors made their money was by lecturing. And that was, to me, one of the things that people have said is that was the age of charisma. That is, you could sell a book. You could sell more books by showing up in public and giving a live performance. Mark Twain, obviously, is the is the example. And then, you know, in the 19th century, in the 20th century, we get sort of the idea, okay, well, I can be an artist. I can be Thomas Pynchon and never go out. I can be James Tiptree Jr. and have an alias. And only the work will stand for what I do. And that's fine.
Salinger, but, too, I suppose.
Salinger. Here we go, Salinger. And so, but now we have a publishing revolution where people are more invested in the author, and I think we're back in an age of charisma. Now, this is not to say that, you know, I'm the most charismatic person you've ever met, but nonetheless...
Though you clearly are, Jim. We'll just say it for you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Okay. The $20 is in the mail. But I think that this is the case, is that people are... When I talk about charisma, you've seen me at this convention. You don't really know a whole lot about me. I mean, if I told you I have a grandson, that's news to you, I think. So it's not about my biography, but it's sort of like how I react, how I act in public, my public persona.
Right.
And so I think one of the key tools for a writer in this century, and I've been talking about this with my students, is, you know, you eventually you're going to have to invent yourself and present yourself as a persona. It could be close to you, it could be a little bit more flamboyant than you really are, but nonetheless, you know, people are going to want to know, people are going to want to connect with you. Then let me just come back to podcasting, because when I first started podcasting, I'd go to conventions and people would walk up to me and say, Jim, say something to me. They just wanted to hear my voice coming out of this body.
Right.
And people would say, I really feel like I know something about you. And all they really know is how I read a story and, you know, how lively my voice is. But, you know, you think about that. If I'm not ashamed to admit, I'm a total NPR fan. You know, have you ever thought about what does Terry Gross look like? You know, Sylvia Pajoli, you know,
right.
Neil Conan, you know, this whole sort of thing is that even though you don't know anything about them, when some of these radio personalities come on, you sort of say, oh yeah, I always listen when Sylvia Pujoli says her name. It's just like too cool for words. And so this is sort of the thing I'm talking about, is charisma, not in the sense of, you know, tell a joke a minute or be dashingly handsome or, you know, or play rock guitar, but sort of in terms of relating to your audience. I think we're in a new era here now.
Well, that's the thing that's interesting, because we usually, when you think of writers, you think of them connecting on the written, using the written word. But here you're saying they also need to do it with the spoken word.
Well, yes. And of course, there's a danger to this. And that is, you know, a very skillful reader actor can sell some pretty ordinary fiction. And so this is something I've had to worry about myself. I mean, not that I'm any great, you know, reader, but I have my certain Shatner-esque moments here where...
You're putting yourself with Shatner here, Jim?
I know.
Really?
That's really high up in the scale. I mean,
really.
He's got multiple comebacks.
Yeah, I suppose.
That's true. Has he lasted forever? Is he now?
He really has.
That's true.
But, you know, in the same way that if you actually, when Shatner is in full Kirk, you know, cry, and he's going, well, Spock, this is trouble for the Enterprise. You know,
right.
That sort of thing, if you think about what he actually said, it's kind of mundane. But Shatner, for all his Emmy-ness, has imbued that line with a great deal of tension. And so this is one of the things we have to think about, we who are also performers, is, man, am I just selling, you know, B material here with an A performance? And I worry about that myself all the time.
Well, you have nothing to worry about in that regard, I don't think. But that is very interesting, and I'm glad to hear. I mean, it's true. We should interview science fiction authors all the time. You have to be the most optimistic people in the world, really. you talk to a lot of. I mean, I write fantasy, and if you talk to fantasy authors, the world is, because we're always looking to what used to be, you know, and everything has fallen apart now. And science fiction writers are always no, but just wait though, because there's so much cool stuff down the line that could happen. So it's kind of refreshing. Right. To have a different take on it. So I guess I'd like to move in a little bit of a different direction about the short story versus the long novel type of work. And sure. I know you've been asked this before because I've listened to a lot of the other interviews that you did as well, but you are particularly well known for your work in short fiction and as a short story writer and then a novella and novelette writer. And I find it funny as I was going through this that how many different ways they could refer to the shortness of your given work. You know, it's not a novella, it's a novelette, it's a novelish, it's a noveling. So I thought that was fun. But I guess the question would be, for you, what are the benefits you think in terms of what's the appeal of the short form over the longer form, especially given the sort of tendency overall, I think, in science fiction and fantasy to kind of towards bloat, I guess I'd say. You know, you go into a bookstore now and everything is longer and longer word counts and, you know, larger books. And it seems that your work, you know, you write work of different lengths, of course, but for the main of your career, you focused on stuff which is against that sort of current. So I wonder if you could speak a little bit about the short form for you.
Can we talk about attention deficit disorder?
Yeah, that's why.
No, well, here's the thing. I actually, I get no points for saying this because it seems like I'm promoting my own little art form, but I think that the short story is harder to write than a novel. Yeah, I mean, you know, in terms of time and conceptualization, yeah, a novel is a big job. But in terms of intensity of feeling and maximizing impact, I think there's nothing quite like a short story or a novelette. So there's, I mean, I think it's a very cool form to be exploring. Mm-hmm. You know, and then the other thing is that it is a very nimble form. In other words, if people are talking about, you know, some scientific breakthrough or some issue, and you're thinking about that too, well, damn, you could sit down and pen a story you can type a story. Oh my God, and we could dial a phone too.
Looking forward.
No, yes, yeah, right. crack that buggy whip. Okay, you know, but if you can react to the issues of the day or even to your own reading with a very quick stroke. And so I like that about it a lot. And then there is the compression of time so that, you know, you can actually, you could spend days and maybe weeks in a novel, you know. But on the other hand, if you're on the subway, you're running like I do, you know, I don't run for 8 hours at a time. I run for maybe 45 minutes or an hour. And so That's just right to hear a story and have a complete aesthetic experience. You know, one of the things that happens a lot with writers is they're asked to read at conventions or at a public reading.
Right.
And it always irks me when I, you know, somebody comes and reads chapter one of a novel. I mean, It irks me in a very minor way because it happens all the time. But nonetheless, it's sort of like, oh, man. Am I ever going to read the rest of this novel? So why am I even paying attention? Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But if somebody lays a short story on you and finishes it in 20 minutes or a half an hour, you know, you have a better sense of that person as an artist. That, you know, this is what he accomplished in this amount of time. And
right.
So, but of course, now we're talking once again about the performance thing. But, you know, it is a thing that very valuable throughout my career is to go out and read my stuff just so I get, you know, some feedback, just so I can eyeball people and see what they think, what they're thinking when I'm reading stuff. It's been very, very valuable to me to know what's going over and what isn't.
And you're right. I think the interesting thing, one of the really interesting things about that is that idea of being buried in the novel, both reading and writing it, because it is true. It just takes longer to produce, you know, to produce a novel. And so you're in it for so long that it becomes, I imagine, even difficult to get a kind of critical distance from it. Whereas if you do a short story, it's not that you dash them off in a few minutes, but, you know, you can finish it. It's got and you can go back and revise it, at least just in terms of the overall time it would take, it'll be less. And so you can get feedback more quickly.
Absolutely. Well, let me tell you another thing that, you know, almost every novelist will tell you is that they hate their novel sometime around page 200 or 193 or 312.
Oh, yeah.
It's not coming together. I never hate a short story. I mean, sometimes I'm you know, a little flummoxed about what's going to happen next, but I'm always having a good time writing these stories. And I think that shows on the page. I mean, it's totally, you know, there's no way to document this, but I think if a writer's having a good time, readers having a good time. time. If a writer is struggling, the reader is saying, oh, do we have to have another, you know, do we have to walk through this forest? Couldn't we just like have a scene break and get to the other side of the forest? No, we have to look at every mossy tree and the birds and, oh no, come on.
This explains so much of my graduate school experience and why I was so tired of Proust. You know, if a guy writes a whole thing in a cork-lined room, there gets to be a point where you think, oh my heavens, no wonder this comes through.
Well,
definitely, I mean, there's times when you want the beautiful language of explaining the intricacies of the world, and there's also times when you want to leave a little bit to the imagination, and I do think you get a little bit more of that with the short story.
Yep.
One thing, I read The Ice Is Singing, and it made me think about a quote you told me once, Greg, about Hemingway and writing the shortest...
Sure.
Short story or something? Like, was it writing the shortest short story?
The short story. Well, it was on a bet. Jim may know this story. It was on a bet, and an editor said, you can't write me a story that is fewer than 10 words. And Hemingway, who made a sort of career on writing as short as he possibly could, responded with, for sale, baby shoes never worn. And that's pretty good.
It's so interesting you should bring this up, because my most published story, my most reprinted story, came out of a contest that Wired magazine did, not a contest, but an invitation, about a year and a half ago, 50 different writers to do the Hemingway thing, write a 6-word story.
Oh,
and,
right.
And so if you Google this, you'll get, you know, the greatest hits of this thing. Wired published about, I don't know, maybe 30 in the magazine, and then the whole, you know, there's another 100 or so on their website. And so let's see. Mine is, we kissed, she melted. Mop, please.
Very, very good. I see.
Well, it was sort of, you know, when Wired calls, you know, geeks
salivate. Yes, they respond. Yes, of course, immediately.
And so it was all science fiction, mostly science fiction people. And so, you know, some graphic novel guys, I think Alan Moore, I can't remember who everyone was. But Ursula Le Guin did one. Margaret Atwood did one.
Wow.
To be in. And so, yeah, Google that. It's sort of an anti-haiku thing. You know, okay, the poets have proprietary rights to haiku, but we fiction writers have the 6-word story, and it's actually a very challenging form.
No one will ever accuse us of being too prosaic again. That's wonderful.
That's right. There you go.
So that's very interesting. Well, let me ask then, and I think this connects to that idea. Another thing that you're very well known for is being able to mix and match voices effortlessly from story to story, which is really on display in Wreck of the Godspeed, by the way, because each of those stories has a tremendously different feel. You know, whether you're talking about a kind of creation myth in Luck, I would say, or the feel of a creation myth, or, you know, in Men Are Trouble, where it's kind of a Dashiell Hammett tribute, you know, with kind of a gender twist thrown in. All of that creates the sense that you're, not that you're reading a different author each time, but that you've entered a very different sort of consciousness in each case. And so I wanted to ask about that. I mean, did you consciously work towards a multi-voiced kind of aesthetic, which is maybe aided by the fact that you write short stories, tend to write more short work than longer work, or was that just kind of an unconscious thing that developed over time?
A little bit of both. You know, I think that your observation is very astute. It's easy to do when you're writing short stories, and you set yourself a different task every time. But I guess this goes back to ancient literary, science fiction literary history. When I broke into the field, way ancient, I went to this writer's workshop called Clarion, which I think I'm now assistant.
Vice chair, I believe.
No, that's what I am. That's it. I'm number 2 on the foundation board. So I went to this workshop with a writer you may have heard of by the name of Bruce Sterling.
Mm-hmm.
Back, he was 20, I was 22. And so we came out of this, Bill Gibson and a bunch of other people sort of were tagged as the cyberpunks, the wave of the future.
Right.
And Bruce, my pal, and but also in some ways my nemesis, had decided that in order for the cyberpunks to be cool, there had to be an uncool group. And so he labeled a bunch of people as humanists, which were sort of like, oh yeah, these are the tired old guys who were writing English major science fiction. Whereas the cyberpunks, we were on the street, we had our leathers, we had our, you know, mirror shades, and we were like really hip and cool, and these other the fuddy duddies, blah blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bruce and his propaganda publication sort of laid out the lines of force in our generation. And so he put me and John Kessel and Connie Willis and Stan Robinson and Nancy Kress and the cool guys were Bill and Lou Scheiner and Bruce and Rudy Rucker. And so, you know, and when I read
that's charming of him to do that, by the way. That's charming.
It was in some ways very helpful to all of us, although, you know, some egos were very bruised because in order for Bruce to propagandize, he had to say, well, these guys really suck. I mean, they just haven't thought about the future at all. And so, what happened was I started, you know, saying, oh, Bruce, yeah, you think this cyberpunk is hard to write? I'll show you some. And so I started writing cyberpunk satire. But Bruce loved it so much that he, when he put out the definitive cyberpunk short story collection, which was called Mirror Shades, he was casting around for enough stories to actually make an anthology. And he actually have enough actual warm bodies to make a movement, which is what he was trying to pretend, well, which was what he was trying to bring into being. And so he bought a story that I regarded as sort of a send-up of cyberpunk, and so I was then anointed as the humanist who turned cyberpunk. But one of the things that this you know made me feel very deeply was I was kind of aghast to realize that people were pegging me as some kind of writer, and I decided, well, look, I'm never going to let anyone do that. If you think you know what I'm about to do, well, my goal is to fool you the next time you read me, and so that's always sort of been what I was after.
Okay.
And do you think, relating to that idea of bloat that I mentioned, I mean, do you think that that can be a corrective, or am I overstating the case? It does feel that every fantasy and science fiction book is tending towards the larger and more spacious, and I'm not sure that's always to the benefit of the prose itself, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that happens when you build a world in a book or in a novel or a trilogy is that, you know, there's a lot of conceptualization, there's a lot of research. There's an old writing saying that talks to this point and says the thing is when we see somebody who's stuck all his research in there, we say, oh, yeah, you suffered for your craft. Now the reader has to suffer. But this is the case, is that you know so much about a world, you've done all the work, and sometimes you sort of lose track of that, you know, you've really dissipated all narrative momentum while you've described the socio-political, you know, construction of your fantasy world. Right?
Right. Yes. I cannot deny it. And, you know, it's interesting. That is one of the things that I've always thought was one of the strongest parts of a movie, like, say, for example, like the original Star Wars, where, you know, you walk into that wretched hive of scum and villainy in Mos Eisley, and you walk into the cantina, and the camera pans around, and you see, I don't know, you know, a hammerhead and a blue elephant and a Wookiee, right. And you don't even know what it is at the time. And not all of that got explained. I can imagine if Robert Jordan had gotten a hold of that, it would have been, and the Wookiee was from five planets, and you know, whereas this just seemed to be very, you got the sense you were on the edge of a larger world, and I think I feel that when I'm reading your work, when I'm reading The Wreck of the Godspeed, or even when I'm reading Burn, that, you know, it's the thousand worlds, right, but you're only focusing on this one, so that seems to be there too.
Michael Swanwick once said that, you know, one of the things, and this sort of was a joke, Michael Swanwick and Garner Dozois are great pals, and he was saying that, I think it's in Stations of the Tide, they're on a boat or someplace, and they're looking out across the water, and a plesiosaur comes out of the water, looks at them, and dives down, and you never get any explanation why there's a plesiosaur in the picture.
It's just there.
And it's exactly that. But just to circle around, there's a downside to this, too, which is if you skipped too much, then what you're doing actually is shutting out readers who would maybe be interested in testing out this weird science fiction thing, but because experienced readers of science fiction are used to holding, you know, these questions in suspension. Well, he'll explain some of this later on. There's been a lot of talk recently in the genre, this may go to some issues we want to talk about later, that maybe this is too closed a system, and it's not, because we have all this shorthand of faster than light and AI, right, and stuff like that, this jargon that readers, longtime readers, get immediately, but new readers could be perplexed by. Sometimes a little explanation isn't a bad thing. You're trying to attract a bigger audience.
That's interesting to sort of broaden the audience that's there. Well, that actually leads me to another question related to this, which is another thing related to science fiction and fantasy about dark versus light. You were asked in an interview once if you were an old-fashioned romantic, and I believe your response was that you kind of bristled at the term because science fiction authors don't want to be considered old-fashioned anything. But I guess I wanted to take that a step further because it seems that a lot of both science fiction and fantasy lately has been given the, I don't know how I'd put it, I guess the dark tag, and almost always positively. You know, dark is considered to be more mature and more thoughtful and more sophisticated, and it's this the chilling new vision and the dark new vision and so forth. And again, I keep feeling like I'm painting you as a contrarian, Jim, and I don't mean to do that, but it just strikes me as being a contrast here, that in your work, it seems that there are a lot of, there certainly are poignant and sad moments and even pathos. The Best Christmas Ever is an example of that for me. It's a very powerful and emotional story, and there's certainly a great deal of sadness at the heart of it, and yet, but it doesn't strike me as bleak. I mean, you know, despite everything, there is kind of this sense that people go on. So I guess I wanted to ask, do you think science fiction has become more driven in a dystopic direction? Maybe I'm overstating that. And is your work working against that at all? Because that may also relate to bringing readers in that would think, gosh, this is really depressing.
Right. Well, I have to say that my earlier work, I think, you're looking at later, and I don't want to say late, but later Jim Kelly. And so I got that a lot. My wife, when she first started reading me, was saying, boy, this is awfully dark. And there's a lot of stuff that is, you know, sort of you struggle on, but still you're going to die. The world is, you know, eclipsed and things are not the greatest.
Right.
But part of what I'm trying to do here is, however you feel about the world we live in today, you know, I don't think you walk around saying, oh, my God, it's the worst of all possible worlds. It's
right.
I just wish I was dead. You
right.
know, it's there's terrible things happening. You know, we make adjustments to this world that would scare the living daylights out of the founding fathers. They would look at this world and say, oh, my God, this is, talk about dystopia. This is dystopia squared, you know,
right.
what we live in. We've allowed all kinds of social groups into the mainstream that we're outcast before. We are isolated. Nobody plays musical instruments. You know, the symphony orchestras are dying. Surely that must be a sign of cultural decline.
And, amen. Right? Amen to that. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I'm down with that. I mean, absolutely. But you know, what is regarded as what we might regard in the future, what you and I might look into the future and say, oh my God, there's a robot president. And some people laugh, that's so funny. That's like a joke out of The Onion or something like that. Well, you know what? It could well be someday. And people who have that kind of, you know, old-fashioned thinking well inside the box with the lock on and a bag inside of it kind of worldview are going to be future shocked by what's coming. My job, I think, as a science fiction writer is to write about a world where things may be sort of bleak or different or they may seem inhuman, but to look at it from the point of view of the people who live there, who have made the adjustments psychologically
right.
and mentally and emotionally and are living in the world as same way that we live in a world with Darfur and global warming and all the things. But still, you know, we love each other. We have kids. We eat breakfast and, you know, we take walks in the forest. And so there's life goes on. You're right. That's right. That's what I'm trying to say. But the life that goes on in the future may not be
a different kind of life.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
But I think it's interesting because there really is a real humanness, humanity about your work, in spite of the technology, in spite of the work that's there, even in things like Think Like a Dinosaur. There's a, you know, of course you're dealing with, because you read the title and you start reading the story and you hear about these dinosaur-like creatures and their complete disinterest in these things that are made. I won't give it away for people who haven't read it. Although if you haven't, go out and get it immediately. Because it's wonderful. But, you know, at the core of that story, I think, is a consideration about the cost of a life and what it's worth and the focus on that life in the face of all of this overwhelming technology. So you really do focus on the humanity of it, I think.
Right. And so one of the things that we like to assume, I mean, and for instance, religions assume is that there are certain things that are written on the fabric of the universe. Thou shalt not kill. You know, the commandments that are inescapable, you know. But one of the things that a science fiction writer does is like questions everything. And under what circumstances would it be all right to do the thing that happens in Think Like a Dinosaur? Or in what circumstances would it be all right, as in a story called Dividing to Sustain, for someone to be pregnant for 3 years? And, you know, it seems like, oh, well, there's another, that's a joke. But in terms of the context of that story, it's a realistic plot point, and it's a motivated by real human emotions.
I know that this happens for me when writing novels, that when I'm writing especially longer novels, I'm sometimes surprised about where a character goes from one place to the next. And you mentioned before about being flummoxed sometimes when you write. Do you find even in the shorter forms that you're often shocked by what a character ends up telling you that he or she is going to do?
Absolutely. Well, you know, and so I will drop in here a very short ad for my story pod project, which is, as I said before, 52 of my stories. But then one of the reasons I was able to sell this to Audible was at the end of each story, there is like a 3 to 5 minute chit chat about how the story, behind the scenes of the making of Think Like a Dinosaur. There's this little chat, which I do, which makes it more like a podcast, because you get to hear my voice and my thoughts about what I wrote. And right. I can't tell you how many times of those 52 stories I said, I got 3/4 of the way through and I realized that the ending I had in mind was the wrong ending. Everybody has their own, you know, term for this, but I think of my unconscious as the little guy. And the little guy is always working, even though the big guy, me, is plotting out these things. The little guy is working underneath the big guy, underneath the conscious artistic process, and coming up with connections that I don't realize. And all of a sudden, many, many, many times in a story, I will realize that the story ending I'm writing to means this when I thought it meant that, or the story ending I'm writing to is the penultimate step, and there's a step beyond that has to happen. Yeah, this happens a lot, is that, you know, an ending suggests itself. And if you're an organic writer like I am, I don't outline hardly at all. And, you know, if I outline it all, it's like at the end of the day, I say, tomorrow he goes into the mess hall, you know. I don't know what that means, but that's where he's going.
Right.
And so if you're an organic writer like me, you live for those moments where something in the story comes together and surprises you, and you know,
like that, it was almost planned.
And you didn't actually plan it. And you know, readers, because you have been fooled all this time, you're surprising your readers. And when you surprise readers, they write you checks.
Right, exactly. That's awfully humanist of you, Jim, it strikes me. Sort of living by the seat of your pants and not believing it, not everything is not planned out for you in advance. And so,
well, yeah. But the street finds its own uses for humanism. And so,
there you go. So I guess the last thing I want to throw at you as a topic is about the state of science fiction and fantasy generally. And, you know, I guess there are some mixed signals here. On the one hand, you have the huge success of things like the superhero films, which they're not classic sci-fi or fantasy, but they certainly mix elements of both. And then more mainstream works like the Harry Potter books and the Lord of the Rings films, sort of in my genre, seems to suggest on the one hand that we're in a golden age. There's a lot of this sort of speculative work coming out. But on the other hand, sci-fi as a genre seems to be shrinking a bit, at least in terms of bringing in new authors and, as you suggested before, maybe new readers. And there is a degree to which genres do get those genres get dismissed a little bit still by some of mainstream society as being kind of, oh, that's the kid stuff or that's the younger stuff. And I guess I wonder what you, having written for 3 decades now,
that's,
you know,
long.
What's I know. What's your take on where we stand in, you can speak to science fiction and fantasy generally or science fiction specifically, where do you think we stand within the genre? Where's it going, do you think?
Well, let me just point out that we're in a historical moment in the media, in film, that we already have been at once before. And that was in the 70s when Star Wars and Close Encounters and Alien came out. Everyone was saying,
right,
oh, God, you know, this is just going to make everyone go out and buy Asimovs. And the fact of the matter is, anything you see in the movies has nothing whatsoever to do with the things you find on the page or podcasting. I mean, those people very rarely look at anything other than, you know, the Harry Potter people read Harry Potter books. You know, Star Trek people read Star Trek books. Star Wars people
get into fights with Star Wars people, actually.
That's right. There you go. In terms of the genre itself, I have to I don't want to disagree with you, because I think that in some way, I mean, in terms of the perception.
No,
of the
please
genre,
disagree with me, please.
Well, in terms of the perception of the genre in the larger world, I think we've actually moved a step in the right direction. And part of this has been the encroachment, as some, you know, reactionary science fiction fans would call it, of the mainstream writers into our turf. You know, Cormac McCarthy's The Road, Margaret Atwood, you know, my pal Jonathan Lethem, who was co-guest of honor with me at ReaderCon. You know, he is, these people are bringing a sort of literary respectability, ambitious literary, well, I don't know, literary in some ways is a too highfalutin a term for science fiction, but ambitious work in science fiction has been sort of pushed, as you point out, to the side a little bit more and more in long, you know, one of the things we have is these long series that are very much like yard goods. and not to say that some of them aren't great. I have several friends who are writing long series, and when you hear this, you know, David Anthony Durham and George R. R. Martin, this isn't you I'm talking about. There are people who just like turn out, well, no, I'm not going to mention this, but there's a guy who is the most famous serializer of all time who recently passed away, and I'm just not that crazy about the work. But those things, these more commercial things, let's call them that, are squeezing the more literary end. And if you want to make, you know, two sides of the scale, yes, the commercial end is going down, is being pushed down by the greater weight of sales and books that are commercial, and the literary end is going up, getting lighter because there are fewer and fewer of them in the marketplace. But that's what the internet is for. That's what the small press is for. And, you know, they're not going to go away. All in all, I think we're, as the writing that's being done, even though some of it isn't making money for its perpetrators, myself not the least of them, is as high a state as it's ever been. And so you can find tons and tons and tons of really, really interesting conceptualization, fine writing, great characters, more than I think than any golden age, that whatever age you want to call the golden age. I'll put our stuff up against, you know, I'll put an issue of Asimov's up against an issue of Astounding from 1950 any day of the week and twice. I think they're better. It's better stuff. And I'll put some of the great, you know, novels that are won Hugos and Nebulas and up against, you know, the classics of all time. You know, even though Isaac Asimov and Heinlein and Clark wrote them, I still think that there's better writing going on today. But, you know, that's just the you know, my opinion. And it's because I'm in this generation, I'm reading what's going on. And so, but on the other hand, I grew up reading the old guys. And so I do have a basis for comparison, which is interesting because a lot of the people that I thought were immortal, Asimov, Heinlein, Clark, you know, in terms of they would always be in print, going out of print like crazy. And, and it's really hard to find some of the people who I thought were, you know, just
that's
God.
True. I guess that's a good point.
Yeah, and I teach a course in fantasy and science fiction at St. John's, which is my day job. Uh-huh. And one of the things that comes up there, and it's odd that every book that I teach, just about every book that I teach in that class, has been or will be made into a movie. Most of them awful, I have to say. And you know, part of it's interesting then to introduce my students to the reality of what the older authors wrote. You know, not the horrendous bastardization of iRobot in the movies, but the actual thing that Asimov really wrote and his view for humanity. One of the interesting things is you do almost have to reintroduce these people who, you're right, I mean, you're old, I'm younger than you, but I also remember my father reading me stories from Asimov and even Edgar Rice Burroughs and right. You know, other classics like that, and finding myself being really drawn into that world. And a lot of these students have no idea until I introduce them in my classrooms to what the classics were. So, you know, they seem to be interested in fantasy and science fiction in a general sense, but you're right. A lot of the old ones are going out of print, and so I guess we need more people who can bridge the gap between the older and the newer then in that sense.
Yeah, well, you know, and I'd like to think that, you know, not that I'm going to stand in Heinlein shoes or Frank Herbert shoes, but I'd like to think that since I did grow up reading these guys, I have a feel for, you know, every so often, I wrote a story called Undone, which was very well received. And, you know, basically that's an homage to Alfred Bester and Cordwainer Smith, two great writers who Cordwainer Smith has actually fared a little bit better than Bester, but those are two of the seminal writers in the field. And you know, when I say, well, this is sort of an homage to them, some people say, well, who the hell are they? That's an interesting name. Cordwainer, what does that mean? Alfred
yeah.
Bester.
Right. Yeah.
Like he was a god.
So you, but I there will be no such issue with you, Jim. I have no doubt that people, who the heck was James Patrick? I have no doubt that your work will continue to propagate over the long run. So that's that'll be positive for you. So I guess I want to conclude with just asking about the ratings for these three things. We talked about two things, and then one I won't make you review. We'll handle that. So the first one is podcasting, and I guess Clea, what's your rating, Clea, on podcasting? And then I'll give mine. And then I'll ask for Jim's, which is the most important. So, Clea, what's your rating for podcasting generally? Where do you think we stand?
We've talked in the past about the limitations, but also the possibilities for podcasting. So I would say it's still young in where it can possibly go. It's still a little bit of a small people's network of just kind of in mm-hmm. amongst themselves. So I would say a 7.
A 7. Okay. I would actually be a little bit higher than that. I would probably say an 8 because of the potential of what it can do. So I'll say an 8 out of 10. Jim, do you have what's your take rating wise on podcasting?
I'd say 9, and I think it's because it is so new and so exciting, and people are still inventing it, that, like you say, the potential for it is huge. The audiences are small, but, you know, I'm thinking that, you know, when people look back on this time, it'll be like when they look back on the golden age of radio or television before it was overrun by sitcoms, and saying, my God, there used to be, like, drama and stuff on TV. Rod Serling wrote dramas before he wrote, you know, video plays. He wrote plays before he wrote Twilight Zone.
So, do you, Jim, do you focus when you're creating something or putting something out, do you focus very much just on the creation of it and then let your future Jim worry about whether or not people are listening or how many people have logged on or how many people have downloaded, or do you go on every day and say it's nothing unless there's people out there listening?
When I'm sitting here, I'm entertaining myself. I'm laughing. I'm happy.
Are you willing to reveal, Jim, your recording setup, which you revealed at ReaderCon, where you normally record?
Yes. Okay. So I have a very up to date laptop, and I have a very nice microphone, couple $300 microphone that is a USB, plugs into my laptop, and I have some great software, some professional software from Sony, and I bring all this cool gear into my walk-in closet, and set my microphone in front of the sweaters, and I read to my sweaters, and they never complain.
Yeah, the sweaters at ReaderCon became a big thing. I mean, it's too bad it happened towards the end, but I heard people walking out and making Kelly sweaters, sweaters Kelly, sweaters. So I love the sweaters thing. I want that to be out there. I'd love to see a cyberpunk devotee talk about sweaters. I'd probably try to graft it on them or something. Okay, so we have a 7, an 8, and a 9 for podcasting. We'll defer to our guest here, I guess, and say that, well, I guess we should average it and say an 8 out of 10 for the three of us. All right, so then the second thing, a rating, is the science fiction to fantasy. And I guess, Jim, I'll start with you on this because it sounds like you're very bullish on the future with fantasy. So you would tend to give this a high rating for where it's going to go, I would guess.
Well, you know what? I would break it down, if I may, into fantasy and science fiction. Right now, I think fantasy is on an upswing and science fiction is a slight downswing. So I'd say fantasy is a 9 and science fiction is an 8. But fantasy is a 9 going up and science fiction is an 8 going down, just in terms of audience and interest.
I think I would totally agree with those ratings. And the 9 is the hopeful part of me saying, I hope so, so that there's more of an audience for the rest of us. But, you know, I think I would agree with the 8 and the 9, respectively, for science fiction fantasy. Clea?
I give them both an 8, and I think that's the tough part. I mean, I'm not the author in the three of us, so I can imagine it's the tough part of doing what you love and having to try not to worry too much about when the audience is going to be there. Are they here now, or they will be in the future? Because, yes, it can. As we all talked about, the attention deficit audience, it can change in a second.
That's right. That's right. They're finicky, but that means they're always one step away from listening to you again, I guess. So that's always a positive. And the last thing we're going to review is Wreck of the Godspeed. And, you know, I'll just say by way of context, Jim, that we can't really give it a 10 because the only thing we've given a 10 to are our daughter and Martin Luther King. Now, and that's not a knock at all on you. You know, let me just say, legitimately think this is a 9, which were it not for Martin Luther King could well be a 10. It's an extremely, extremely well done anthology. And I have read a lot of Jim's earlier stories too, but I just focused on that because it is just out from Golden Griffin Press. And it's not only a very well put together book physically, you know, it's something which is going to stand the test of time. The writing in it is really wonderful. and demonstrates what everyone always says about Jim. If you Google him and, you know, read listen to interviews of him, everyone always says his range and his voice are the things that come through, and that comes through very strongly through these pages. So, you know, well deserved all the Hugas and Nebulas that the stories in there that were nominated for or won them. So I would say a 9. Clea?
Well, I was worried that I wasn't going to be able to read enough before this interview, but because I'm such a slow reader.
But a careful one, my dear.
But this book really made it possible for me to really feel that I could really accomplish the task because, as you said, there are so many different voices, so many different stories, and I don't have to feel overwhelmed that they're, you know, the ending is 300 pages away. I didn't feel the weight over my shoulders at all, and so I felt very easy when I read it. It was very easy to be pulled in and intrigued and fascinated by every single story. So I'd say a 9 as well.
9 as well. So 9 for Wreck of the Godspeed, and we will put, of course, links to all of that up on our site. So, Jim, I can't thank you enough for agreeing to do the interview with us, and we very much enjoyed having you on the show, and perhaps sometime in the future we can have you back on again to talk about where we've come now when we have, you know, robot presidents and when podcasting is the norm and not the exception. But thank you so, so much for being on the show.
Thank you, my friends. It was a joy talking to you, and I had some laughs. You did, too. That's good.
So, upon further review, I'm Greg.
I'm Clea, and thanks, Jim. Give our best to your sweaters.
Bye.
The proceeding was a presentation of Upon Further Review, hosted at www.furtherreview.net. As usual, all rights are reserved. If you liked what you heard, please vote for us at podcastalley.com, vitalpodcast.com, and add us to your list of favorites at podcastpickle.com. You can leave us a comment at www.furtherreview.net, drop us a line at upon@furtherreview.net, or give us a phone call or send a fax to 206-339-UFR1. That's 206-339-8371. And lastly, don't be afraid to express your opinions. We know you have them. Let them out. Feel the power. Or you could just blindly accept whatever we tell you is fact. That'll work.
Bravo!
I loved that.
Oh, it was great.
Well, it was pretty good.
Well, it wasn't bad.
Well, there were parts of it that weren't very good,
it
though.
It could have been a lot better.
I didn't really like it.
It was pretty terrible.
It was bad.
It was awful.
It was terrible.
Get him away!
Hey, boo!
Boo!